compel the object of your desire. This is because your interest is too strong. It makes people awkward, even fearful. Uncontrollable desire makes you seem weak, unworthy, pathetic. You need to turn your back on what you want. Show your contempt and disdain. This is the kind of powerful response that will drive your targets crazy. They will respond with a desire of their own, which is simply to have an effect on you. Perhaps to possess you, perhaps to hurt you. If they want to possess you, you have successfully completed the first step of seduction. If they want to hurt you, you have unsettled them and made them play by your rules. Contempt is the prerogative of the king. Where his eyes turn, what he decides to see is what has reality. What he ignores and turns his back on is as good as dead. That was the weapon of King Louis XIV. If he didn't like you, he acted as if you weren't there, maintaining his superiority by cutting off the dynamic of interaction. This is the power you have when you play the card of contempt, periodically showing people that you can do without them. If choosing to ignore enhances your power, it follows that the opposite approach, commitment and engagement, often weakens you. By paying undue attention to a puny enemy, you look puny, and the longer it takes you to crush such an enemy, the larger the enemy seems. When Athens set out to conquer the island of Sicily in 415 BC, a giant power was attacking a tiny one. Yet by entangling Athens in a long, drawn-out conflict, Syracuse, Sicily's most important city-state, was able to grow in stature and confidence. Finally, defeating Athens, it made itself famous for centuries to come. In recent times, President John F. Kennedy made a similar mistake in his attitude to Fidel Castro of Cuba. His failed invasion at the Bay of Pigs in 1961 made Castro an international hero. A second danger. If you succeed in crushing the irritant, or even if you merely wound it, you create sympathy for the weaker side. Critics of Franklin D. Roosevelt complained bitterly about the money his administration spent on government projects. But their attacks had no resonance with the public, who saw the president as working to end the Great Depression. His opponents thought they had an example that would show just how wasteful he had become. His dog, Fala, which he lavished with favors and attention. Critics railed at his insensitivity, spending taxpayers' money on a dog, while so many Americans were still in poverty. But Roosevelt had a response. How dare his critics attack a defenseless little dog? His speech in defense of Fala was one of the most popular he ever gave. In this case, the weak party involved was the president's dog, and the attack backfired. In the long run, it only made the president more sympathetic, since many people will naturally side with the underdog, just as the American public came to sympathize with the wily but outnumbered Pancho Villa. It is tempting to want to fix our mistakes, but the harder we try, the worse we often make them. It is sometimes more politic to leave them alone. In 1971, when the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers, a group of government documents about the history of U.S. involvement in Indochina, Henry Kissinger erupted into a volcanic rage. Furious about the Nixon administration's vulnerability to this kind of damaging leak, he made recommendations that eventually led to the formation of a group called the Plumbers to plug the leaks. This was the unit that later broke into the Democratic Party offices in the Watergate Hotel, setting off the chain of events that led to Nixon's downfall. In reality, the publication of the Pentagon Papers was not a serious threat to the administration, but Kissinger's reaction made it a big deal. In trying to fix one problem, he created another, a paranoia for security that in the end was much more destructive to the government. Had he ignored the Pentagon Papers, the scandal they had created would eventually have blown over. Instead of inadvertently focusing attention on a problem, making it seem worse by publicizing how much concern and anxiety it is causing you, it is often far wiser to play the contemptuous aristocrat, not deigning to acknowledge the problem's existence. There are several ways to execute this strategy. First, there is the sour grapes approach. If there is something you want, but that you realize you cannot have, the worst thing you can do is draw attention to your disappointment by complaining about it. An infinitely more powerful tactic is to act as if it never really interested you in the first place. When the writer George Sand's supporters nominated her to be the first female member of the Académie Française in 1861, Sand quickly saw that the Academy would never admit her. Instead of whining, though, she claimed she had no interest in belonging to this group of worn-out, overrated, out-of-touch windbags. Her disdain was the perfect response. Had she shown her anger at her exclusion, she would have revealed how much it meant to her. Instead, she branded the Academy a club of old men. And why should she be angry or disappointed at not having to spend her time with them? Crying sour grapes is sometimes seen as a reflection of the weak. It is actually the tactic of the powerful. Second, when you are attacked by an inferior, deflect people's attention by making it clear that the attack has not even registered. Look away, or answer sweetly, showing how little the attack concerns you. Similarly, when you yourself have committed a blunder, the best response is often to make less of your mistake by treating it lightly. The Japanese emperor, Go-Sayen, a great disciple of the tea ceremony, owned a priceless antique tea bowl that all the courtiers envied. One day a guest, Dainigon Sunihiro, asked if he could carry the tea bowl into the light to examine it more closely. The bowl rarely left the table, but the emperor was in good spirits, and he consented. As Dainigon carried the bowl to the railing of the veranda, however, and held it up to the light, it slipped from his hands and fell on a rock in the garden below, smashing into tiny fragments. The emperor, of course, was furious. "It was indeed most clumsy of me to let it drop in this way," said Dainigon, with a deep bow. "But really, there is not much harm done. This Edo tea bowl is a very old one, and it is impossible to say how much longer it would have lasted. But anyhow, it is not a thing of any public use, so I think it rather fortunate that it has broken thus." This surprising response had an immediate effect. The emperor calmed down. Dainagon neither sniveled nor over-apologized, but signaled his own worth and power by treating his mistake with a touch of disdain. The emperor had to respond with a similar aristocratic indifference. His anger had made him seem low and petty, an image Dainagon was able to manipulate. Among equals, this tactic might backfire. Your indifference could make you seem callous. But with a master, if you act quickly and without great fuss, it can work to great effect. You bypass his angry response, save him the time and energy he would waste by brooding over it, and allow him the opportunity to display his own lack of pettiness publicly. If we make excuses and denials when we are caught in a mistake or a deception, we stir the waters and make the situation worse. It is often wiser to play things the opposite way. The Renaissance writer Pietro Aretino often boasted of his aristocratic lineage, which was, of course, a fiction, since he was actually the son of a shoemaker. When an enemy of his finally revealed the embarrassing truth, word quickly spread, and soon all of Venice, where he lived at the time, was aghast at Aretino's lies. Had he tried to defend himself, he would have only dragged himself down. His response was masterful. He announced that he was indeed the son of a shoemaker, but this only proved his greatness, since he had risen from the lowest stratum of society to its very pinnacle. From then on, he never mentioned his previous lie, trumpeting instead his new position on the matter of his ancestry. Remember, the powerful responses to niggling petty annoyances and irritations are contempt and disdain. Never show that something has affected you, or that you are offended. That only shows you have acknowledged a problem. Contempt is a dish that is best served cold and without affectation. Reversal. You must play the card of contempt with care and delicacy. Most small troubles will vanish on their own if you leave them be, but some will grow and fester unless you attend to them. Ignore a person of inferior stature, and the next time you look, he has become a serious rival, and your contempt has made him vengeful as well. The great princes of Renaissance Italy chose to ignore Cesare Borgia at the outset of his career as a young general in the army of his father, Pope Alexander VI. By the time they paid attention, it was too late. The cub was now a lion, gobbling up chunks of Italy. Often, then, while you show contempt publicly, you will also need to keep an eye on the problem privately, monitoring its status and making sure it goes away. Do not let it become a cancerous cell. Develop the skill of sensing problems when they are still small and taking care of them before they become intractable. Learn to distinguish between the potentially disastrous and the mildly irritating, the nuisance that will quietly go away on its own. In either case, though, never completely take your eye off it. As long as it is alive, it can smolder and spark into life. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Fables by Jean de La Fontaine. The Fox and the Grapes. A starving fox saw a cluster of luscious-looking grapes of purplish luster, dangling above him on a trellis frame. He would have dearly liked them for his lunch, but when he tried and failed to reach the bunch, "Ah, well, it's more than likely they're not sweet. Good only for green fools to eat." Wasn't he wise to say they were unripe, rather than whine and gripe? From the Little Brown Book of Anecdotes. Once, when G.K. Chesterton's economic views were abused in print by George Bernard Shaw, his friends waited in vain for him to reply. Historian Hilaire Belloc reproached him. "My dear Belloc," Chesterton said, "I have answered him. To a man of Shaw's wit, silence is the one unbearable repartee." From Fables, Pilpai, India. The Ass and the Gardener. An ass had once by some accident lost his tail, which was a grievous affliction to him, and he was everywhere seeking after it, being fool enough to think he could get it set on again. He passed through a meadow and afterwards got into a garden. The gardener, seeing him and not able to endure the mischief he was doing in trampling down his plants, fell into a violent rage, ran to the ass, and never standing on the ceremony of a pillory, cut off both his ears, and beat him out of the ground. Thus the ass, who bemoaned the loss of his tail, was in far greater affliction when he saw himself without ears. From Essays in Idleness, Kenko, Japan. The Prodigy Ox. Once, when the Tokudaiji minister of the right was chief of the imperial police, he was holding a meeting of his staff at the middle gate, when an ox, belonging to an official named Akikane, got loose and wandered into the ministry building. It climbed up on the dais where the chief was seated and lay there chewing its cud. Everyone was sure that this was some grave portent, and urged that the ox be sent to a yin-yang diviner. However, the prime minister, the father of the minister of the right, said, "An ox has no discrimination. It has legs. There is nowhere it won't go. It does not make sense to deprive an underpaid official of the wretched ox he needs in order to attend court." He returned the ox to its owner and changed the matting on which it had lain. No untoward event of any kind occurred afterward. They say that if you see a prodigy and do not treat it as such, its character as a prodigy is destroyed. From Arthur Schopenhauer. "And in this view, it is advisable to let every one of your acquaintance, whether man or woman, feel now and then that you could very well dispense with their company. This will consolidate friendship. Nay, with most people, there will be no harm in occasionally mixing a grain of disdain with your treatment of them. That will make them value your friendship all the more. Chi non stima vien stimato, as a subtle Italian proverb has it. To disregard is to win regard. But if we really think very highly of a person, we should conceal it from him like a crime. This is not a very gratifying thing to do, but it is right. Why, a dog will not bear being treated too kindly, let alone a man." From Fables by Leo Tolstoy. The Monkey and the Peas. A monkey was carrying two handfuls of peas. One little pea dropped out. He tried to pick it up and spilt 20. He tried to pick up the 20 and spilt them all. Then he lost his temper, scattered the peas in all directions, and ran away. and from Baltasar Gracian. As some make gossip out of everything, so others make much ado about everything. They are always talking big and take everything seriously, making a quarrel and a mystery of it. You should take very few grievances to heart, for to do so is to give yourself groundless worry. It is a topsy-turvy way of behaving to take to heart cares which you ought to throw over your shoulder. Many things which seemed important at the time turn out to be of no account when they are ignored, and others which seem trifling appear formidable when you pay attention to them. Things can easily be settled at the outset, but not so later on. In many cases, the remedy itself is the cause of the disease. To let things be is not the least satisfactory of life's rules. The 37th Law. Create compelling spectacles. Striking imagery and grand symbolic gestures create the aura of power. Everyone responds to them. Stage spectacles for those around you, then, full of arresting visuals and radiant symbols that heighten your presence. Dazzled by appearances, no one will notice what you are really doing. Observance of the Law, Number 1. In the early 1780s, word spread through Berlin of the strange and spectacular medical practices of a Dr. Weisleder. He performed his miracles in an enormous converted beer hall, outside which Berliners began to notice ever longer lines of people. The blind, the lame, anyone with an illness incurable by normal medicine. When it leaked out that the doctor worked by exposing the patient to the rays of the moon, he soon became dubbed the Moon Doctor of Berlin. Sometime in 1783, it was reported that Dr. Weisleder had cured a well-to-do woman of a terrible ailment. He suddenly became a celebrity. Previously, only the poorest Berliners had been seen waiting outside the beer hall in their rags. Now, magnificent carriages were parked outside, and gentlemen in frock coats and ladies with enormous coiffures lined the street as sunset drew near. Even folk with the mildest of ailments came out of sheer curiosity. As they waited in line, the poorer clients would explain to the gentlemen and ladies that the doctor only practiced when the moon was in its increscent phase. Many would add that they themselves had already been exposed to the healing powers he called forth from the rays of the moon. Even those who felt cured kept coming back, drawn by this powerful experience. Inside the beer hall, a strange and stirring spectacle greeted the visitor. Packed into the entrance hall was a crowd of all classes and ethnic backgrounds, a veritable Tower of Babel. Through tall windows on the northern side of the hall, silvery moonlight poured in at odd angles. The doctor and his wife, who, it seemed, was also able to effect the cure, practiced on the second floor, which was reached by a stairway at the end of the hall. As the line edged closer to the stairs, the sick would hear shouts and cries from above, and word would spread of, perhaps, a blind gentleman suddenly able to see. Once upstairs, the line would fork in two directions, toward a northern room for the doctor, a southern one for his wife, who worked only on the ladies. Finally, after hours of anticipation and waiting in line, the gentleman patients would be led before the amazing doctor himself, an elderly man with a few stalks of wild gray hair and an air of nervous energy. He would take the patient, let us say a young boy, brought in by his father, uncover the afflicted body part, and lift the boy up to the window, which faced the light of the moon. He would rub the site of the injury or illness, mumble something unintelligible, look knowingly at the moon, and then, after collecting his fee, send the boy and his father on their way. Meanwhile, in the south-facing room, his wife would be doing the same with the ladies, which was odd, really, since the moon cannot appear in two places at once. It cannot have been visible, in other words, from both windows. Apparently the mere thought, idea, and symbol of the moon were enough, for the ladies didn't complain, and would later remark confidently that the wife of the moon doctor had the same healing powers as he. Interpretation. Dr. Weisleder may have known nothing about medicine, but he understood human nature. He recognized that people do not always want words or rational explanations or demonstrations of the powers of science. They want an immediate appeal to their emotions, Give them that, and they will do the rest. Such as imagine they can be healed by the light reflected from a rock 250,000 miles away. Dr. Weisleder had no need of pills, or of lengthy lectures on the moon's power, or of any silly gadgetry to amplify its rays. He understood that the simpler the spectacle, the better. Just the moonlight pouring in from the side, the stairway leading to the heavens, and the rays of the moon, whether directly visible or not. Any added effects might have made it seem that the moon was not strong enough on its own. And the moon was strong enough. It was a magnet for fantasies, as it has been throughout history. Simply by associating himself with the image of the moon, the doctor gained power. Remember, your search for power depends on shortcuts. You must always circumvent people's suspicions, the perverse desire to resist your will. Images are an extremely effective shortcut. Bypassing the head, the seat of doubt and resistance, they aim straight for the heart. Overwhelming the eyes, they create powerful associations, bringing people together and stirring their emotions. With the white light of the moon in their eyes, your targets are blinded to the deceptions you practice. Observance of the Law Number 2. In 1536, the future king, Henri II of France, took his first mistress, Diane de Poitiers. Diane was 37 at the time, and was the widow of the Grand Seneschal of Normandy. Henri, meanwhile, was a sprightly lad of 17, who was just beginning to sow his wild oats. At first their union seemed merely platonic, with Henri showing an intensely spiritual devotion to Diane. But it soon became clear that he loved her in every way, preferring her bed to that of his young wife, Catherine de Médicis. In 1547, King Francis died, and Henri ascended to the throne. This new situation posed perils for Diane de Poitiers. She had just turned 48, and despite her notorious cold baths and rumored youth potions, she was beginning to show her age. Now that Henri was king, perhaps he would return to the queen's bed, and do as other kings had done, choose mistresses from the bevy of beauties who made the French court the envy of Europe. He was, after all, only 28 and cut a dashing figure. But Diane did not give up so easily. She would continue to enthrall her lover as she enthralled him for the past 11 years. Diane's secret weapons were symbols and images, to which she had always paid great attention. Early on in her relationship with Henri, she had created a motif by intertwining her initials with his to symbolize their union. The idea worked like a charm. Henri put this insignia everywhere, on his royal robes, on monuments, on churches, on the façade of the Louvre, then the royal palace in Paris. Diane's favorite colors were black and white, which she wore exclusively, and wherever it was possible, the insignia appeared in these colors. Everyone recognized the symbol and its meaning. Soon after Henri took the throne, however, Diane went still further. She decided to identify herself with the Roman goddess Diana, her namesake. Diana was the goddess of the hunt, the traditional royal pastime and the particular passion of Henri. Equally important, in Renaissance art she symbolized chastity and purity. For a woman like Diane to identify herself with this goddess would instantly call up those images in the court, giving her an air of respectability. Symbolizing her chaste relationship with Henri, it would also set her apart from the adulterous liaisons of royal mistresses past. To effect this association, Diane began by completely transforming her castle at Annay. She razed the building structure, and in its place erected a magnificent Doric-columned edifice modeled after a Roman temple. It was made in white Normandy stone, flecked with black silex, reproducing Diane's trademark colors of black and white. The insignia of her and Henri's initials appeared on the columns, the doors, the windows, the carpet. Meanwhile, symbols of Diana, crescent moons, stags, and hounds adorned the gates and facade. Inside, enormous tapestries depicting episodes in the life of the goddess lay on the floors and hung on the walls. In the garden stood the famous Gigon sculpture Diane Chasseuse, which is now in the Louvre, and which had an uncanny resemblance to Dion de Poitiers. Paintings and other depictions of Diana appeared in every corner of the castle. Anne overwhelmed Henri, who soon was trumpeting the image of Dion de Poitiers as a Roman goddess. In 1548, when the couple appeared together in Lyon for a royal celebration, the townspeople welcomed them with a tableau vivant, depicting a scene with Diana the huntress. France's greatest poet of the period, Pierre de Ronsard, began to write verses in honor of Diana. Indeed, a kind of cult of Diana sprang up, all inspired by the king's mistress. It seemed to Henri that Dion had given herself a kind of divine aura, and as if he were destined to worship her for the rest of his life. And until his death in 1559, he did remain faithful to her, making her a duchess, giving her untold wealth, and displaying an almost religious devotion to his first and only mistress. Interpretation. Dion de Poitiers, a woman from a modest bourgeois background, managed to captivate Henri for over 20 years. By the time he died, she was well into her 60s, yet his passion for her only increased with the years. She knew the king well. He was not an intellectual, but a lover of the outdoors. He particularly loved jousting tournaments, with their bright pennants, brilliantly caparisoned horses, and beautifully dressed women. Henri's love of visual splendor seemed childlike to Dion, and she played on this weakness of his at every opportunity. Most astute of all was Dion's appropriation of the goddess Diana. Here she took the game beyond physical imagery, into the realm of the psychic symbol. It was quite a feat to transform a king's mistress into an emblem of power and purity, but she managed it. Without the resonance of the goddess, Dion was merely an aging courtesan. With the imagery and symbolism of Diana on her shoulders, she seemed a mythic force, destined for greatness. You too can play with images like these, weaving visual cues into an encompassing gestalt, as Dion did with her colors and her insignia. Establish a trademark like these to set yourself apart. Then take the game further. Find an image or symbol from the past that will neatly fit your situation and put it on your shoulders like a cape. It will make you seem larger than life. In the words of Louis XIV, the Sun King, because of the light it shines on the other stars, which make up a kind of court around it, because of the just and equal distribution of its rays to all alike, because of the good it brings to all places, producing life, joy, and action, because of its constancy, from which it never varies, I chose the sun as the most magnificent image to represent a great leader. Keys to power. Using words to plead your case is risky business. Words are dangerous instruments and often go astray. The words people use to persuade us virtually invite us to reflect on them with words of our own. We mull them over, and often end up believing the opposite of what they say. That is part of our perverse nature. It also happens that words offend us, stirring up associations unintended by the speaker. The visual, on the other hand, short-circuits the labyrinth of words. It strikes with an emotional power and immediacy that leave no gaps for reflection and doubt. Like music, it leaps right over rational, reasonable thoughts. Imagine the moon doctor trying to make a case for his medical practice, trying to convince the unconverted by telling them about the healing powers of the moon, and about his own special connection to a distant object in the sky. Fortunately for him, he was able to create a compelling spectacle that made words unnecessary. The moment his patients entered the beer hall, the image of the moon spoke eloquently enough. Understand, words put you on the defensive. If you have to explain yourself, your power is already in question. The image, on the other hand, imposes itself as a given. It discourages questions, creates forceful associations, resists unintended interpretations, communicates instantly, and forges bonds that transcend social differences. Words stir up arguments and divisions. Images bring people together. They are the quintessential instruments of power. The symbol has the same force, whether it is visual, the statue of Diana, or a verbal description of something visual. The words, the Sun King. The symbolic object stands for something else, something abstract, such as the image Diana standing for chastity. The abstract concept, purity, patriotism, courage, love, is full of emotional and powerful associations. The symbol is a shortcut of expression, containing dozens of meanings in one simple phrase or object. The symbol of the Sun King, as explained by Louis XIV, can be read on many layers. But the beauty of it is that its associations required no explanation, spoke immediately to his subjects, distinguished him from all other kings, and conjured up a kind of majesty that went far beyond the words themselves. The symbol contains untold power. The first step in using symbols and images is to understand the primacy of sight among the senses. Before the Renaissance, it has been argued, sight and the other senses, taste, touch, and so on, operated on a relatively equal plane. Since then, however, the visual has come to dominate the others, and is the sense we most depend on and trust. As Gracian said, the truth is generally seen, rarely heard. When the Renaissance painter Fra Filippo Lippi was a captured slave among the Moors, he won his freedom by sketching a drawing of his master on a white wall with a piece of charcoal. When the owner saw the drawing, he instantly understood the power of a man who could make such images, and let Fra Lippi go. That one image was far more powerful than any argument the artist could have made with words. Never neglect the way you arrange things visually. Factors like color, for example, have enormous symbolic resonance. When the con artist Yellow Kid Weil created a newsletter touting the phony stocks he was peddling, he called it the Red Letter Newsletter, and had it printed at considerable expense in red ink. The color created a sense of urgency, power, and good fortune. Weil recognized details like these as keys to deception, as do modern advertisers and mass marketers. If you use gold in the title of anything you are trying to sell, for example, print it in gold. Since the eye predominates, people will respond more to the color than to the word. The visual contains great emotional power. The Roman Emperor Constantine worshipped the sun as a god for most of his life. One day, though, he looked up at the sun and saw a cross superimposed on it. The vision of the cross over the sun proved to him the ascendancy of the new religion. And he converted not just himself, but the whole Roman Empire to Christianity soon thereafter. All the preaching and proselytizing in the world could not have been as powerful. Find and associate yourself with the images and symbols that will communicate in this immediate way today, and you will have untold power. Most effective of all is a new combination, a fusion of images and symbols that have not been seen together before, but that through their association clearly demonstrate your new idea, message, religion. The creation of new images and symbols out of old ones in this way has a poetic effect. Viewers' associations run rampant, giving them a sense of participation. Visual images often appear in a sequence, and the order in which they appear creates a symbol. The first to appear, for instance, symbolizes power. The image at the center seems to have central importance. Near the end of World War II, orders came down from General Eisenhower that American troops were to lead the way into Paris after its liberation from the Nazis. The French general, Charles de Gaulle, however, realized that this sequence would imply that the Americans now commanded the fate of France. Through much manipulation, de Gaulle made certain that he and the French 2nd Armored Division would appear at the head of the liberating force. The strategy worked. After he had successfully pulled off this stunt, the Allies started treating him as the new leader of an independent France. De Gaulle knew that a leader has to locate himself literally at the head of his troops. This visual association is crucial to the emotional response that he needs to elicit. Things change in the game of symbols. It is probably no longer possible to pose as a Sun King or to wrap the mantle of Diana around you. Yet you can associate yourself with such symbols more indirectly. And of course, you can make your own mythology out of figures from more recent history. People who are comfortably dead but still powerfully associative in the public eye. The idea is to give yourself an aura, a stature that your normal banal appearance simply will not create. By herself, Dionne de Poitiers had no such radiant powers. She was as human and ordinary as most of us. But the symbol elevated her above the human lot and made her seem divine. Using symbols also has a courtier-like effect, since they are often gentler than brutish words. The psychotherapist Dr. Milton H. Erickson always tried to find symbols and images that would communicate to the patient in ways that words could not. When dealing with a severely troubled patient, he would not question him directly, but would talk about something irrelevant, such as driving through the desert in Arizona, where he practiced in the 1950s. In describing this, he would eventually come to an appropriate symbol for what he suspected was the man's problem. If he felt the patient was isolated, say, Dr. Erickson would talk of a single ironwood tree and how its isolation left it battered by the winds. Making an emotional connection with the tree as a symbol, the patient would open up more readily to the doctor's probing. Use the power of symbols as a way to rally, animate, and unite your troops or team. During the rebellion against the French crown in 1648, those loyal to the king disparaged the rebels by comparing them to the slingshots, in French, fronds, that little boys use to frighten big boys. Cardinal de Retz decided to turn this disparaging term into the rebels' symbol. The uprising was now known as the Fronde, and the rebels as Frondeurs. They began to wear sashes in their hats that symbolized the slingshot, and the word became their rallying cry. Without it, the rebellion might well have petered out. Always find a symbol to represent your cause. The more emotional associations, the better. The best way to use images and symbols is to organize them into a grand spectacle that awes people and distracts them from unpleasant realities. This is easy to do. People love what is grand, spectacular, and larger than life. Appeal to their emotions, and they will flock to your spectacle in hordes. The visual is the easiest route to their hearts. Reversal. No power is made available by ignoring images and symbols. There is no possible reversal to this law. Here are some further reflections on this law. From The Life of Antony by Plutarch. Antony and Cleopatra. She relied above all upon her physical presence and the spell and enchantment which it could create. She came sailing up the river Cydnus in a barge with a poop of gold, its purple sails billowing in the wind, while her rowers caressed the water with oars of silver, which dipped in time to the music of the flute, accompanied by pipes and lutes. Cleopatra herself reclined beneath a canopy of cloth of gold, dressed in the character of Aphrodite, as we see her in paintings, while on either side, to complete the picture, stood boys costumed as Cupids, who cooled her with their fans. Instead of a crew, the barge was lined with the most beautiful of her waiting women, attired as nereids and graces, some at the rudders, others at the tackle of the sails. And all the while, an indescribably rich perfume, exhaled from innumerable censers, was wafted from the vessel to the riverbanks. Great multitudes accompanied this royal progress, some of them following the queen on both sides of the river from its very mouth, while others hurried down from the city of Tarsus to gaze at the sight. Gradually the crowds drifted away from the marketplace, where Antony awaited the queen enthroned on his tribunal, until at last he was left sitting quite alone. And the word spread on every side that Aphrodite had come to revel with Dionysus for the happiness of Asia. Antony then sent a message inviting Cleopatra to dine with him. But she thought it more appropriate that he should come to her. And so, as he wished to show his courtesy and goodwill, he accepted and went. He found the preparations made to receive him magnificent beyond words. But what astonished him most of all was the extraordinary number of lights. So many of these, it is said, were let down from the roof and displayed on all sides at once. And they were arranged and grouped in such ingenious patterns in relation to each other, some in squares and some in circles, that they created as brilliant a spectacle as can ever have been devised to delight the eye. From The Waning of the Middle Ages by Johann Huizinga. In the Middle Ages, the symbolist attitude was much more in evidence. Symbolism appears as a sort of shortcut of thought. Instead of looking for the relation between two things by following the hidden detours of their casual connections, thought makes a leap and discovers their relation not in the connection of cause and effects, but in the connection of signification. Symbolist thought permits an infinity of relations between things. Each thing may denote a number of distinct ideas by its different special qualities, and a quality may have several symbolic meanings. The highest conceptions have symbols by the thousand. Nothing is too humble to represent and glory the sublime. The walnut signifies Christ. The sweet kernel is his divine nature. The green and pulpy outer peel is his humanity. The wooden shell in between is the cross. Thus all things raise his thoughts to the eternal. Every precious stone, besides its natural splendor, sparkles with the brilliance of its symbolic values. The assimilation of roses and virginity is much more than a poetic comparison, for it reveals their common essence. As each notion arises in the mind, the logic of symbolism creates a harmony of ideas. Shanoyu, the Japanese tea ceremony. There was a man named Sakamotoya Hechiguan, who lived in Upper Kyoto. When Emperor Hideyoshi gave his great Shanoyu tea ceremony meeting at Kitano in the 10th month of 1588, Hechiguan set up a great red umbrella 9 feet across, mounted on a stick 7 feet high. The circumference of the handle is surrounded for about 2 feet by a reed fence, in such a way that the rays of the sun were reflected from it and diffused the color of the umbrella all around. This device pleased Hideyoshi so much that he remitted Hechiguan's taxes as a reward. The 38th Law. Think as you like, but behave like others. Judgment. If you make a show of going against the times, flaunting your unconventional ideas and unorthodox ways, people will think that you only want attention, and that you look down upon them. They will find a way to punish you for making them feel inferior. It is far safer to blend in and nurture the common touch. Share your originality only with tolerant friends, and those who are sure to appreciate your uniqueness. Transgression of the Law. Around the year 478 BC, the city of Sparta sent an expedition to Persia, led by the young Spartan nobleman Pausanias. The city-states of Greece had recently fought off a mighty invasion from Persia, and now Pausanias, along with allied ships from Athens, had orders to punish the invaders and win back the islands and coastal towns that the Persians had occupied. Both the Athenians and the Spartans had great respect for Pausanias. He had proven himself as a fearless warrior, with a flair for the dramatic. With amazing speed, Pausanias and his troops took Cyprus, then moved on to the mainland of Asia Minor, known as the Hellespont, and captured Byzantium, modern-day Istanbul. Now master of part of the Persian Empire, Pausanias began to show signs of behavior that went beyond his normal flamboyance. He appeared in public wearing pomades in his hair and flowing Persian robes, and accompanied by a bodyguard of Egyptians. He held lavish banquets, in which he sat in the Persian manner, and demanded to be entertained. He stopped seeing his old friends, entered into communication with the Persian king Xerxes, and all in all affected the style and manner of a Persian dictator. Clearly power and success had gone to Pausanias's head. His army, Athenians and Spartans alike, first thought this a passing fancy. He had always been a bit exaggerated in his gestures. But when he flaunted his disdain for the Greeks' simple way of life and insulted the common Greek soldier, they began to feel he had gone too far. Although there was no concrete evidence for this, rumors spread that he had gone over to the other side and that he dreamed of becoming a kind of Greek Xerxes. To quell the possibility of mutiny, the Spartans relieved Pausanias of his command and called him home. Pausanias, however, continued to dress in the Persian style, even in Sparta. After a few months, he independently hired a trireme and returned to the Hellespont, telling his compatriots he was going to continue the fight against the Persians. Actually, however, he had different plans. to make himself ruler of all Greece with the aid of Xerxes himself. The Spartans declared him a public enemy and sent a ship to capture him. Pausanias surrendered, certain that he could clear himself of the charges of treason. It did come out during the trial that during his reign as commander he had offended his fellow Greeks time and again, erecting monuments, for instance, in his own name, rather than in those of the cities whose troops had fought alongside him, as was the custom. Yet Pausanias proved right. Despite the evidence of his numerous contacts with the enemy, the Spartans refused to imprison a man of such noble birth and let him go. Now, thinking himself untouchable, Pausanias hired a messenger to take a letter to Xerxes. But the messenger instead took the letter to the Spartan authorities. These men wanted to find out more, so they had the messenger arrange to meet Pausanias in a temple where they could hide and listen behind a partition. What Pausanias said shocked them. They had never heard such contempt for their ways spoken so brazenly by one of their own, and they made arrangements for his immediate arrest. On his way home from the temple, Pausanias got word of what had happened. He ran to another temple to hide, but the authorities followed him there and placed sentries all around. Pausanias refused to surrender. Unwilling to forcibly remove him from the sacred temple, the authorities kept him trapped inside until he eventually died of starvation. Interpretation. At first glance, it might seem that Pausanias simply fell in love with another culture, a phenomenon as old as time. Never comfortable with the asceticism of the Spartans, he found himself enthralled by the Persian love of luxury and sensual pleasure. He put on Persian robes and perfumes with a sense of deliverance from Greek discipline and simplicity. This is how it appears when people adopt a culture in which they were not raised. Often, however, there was also something else at play. People who flaunt their infatuation with a different culture are expressing a disdain and contempt for their own. They are using the outward appearance of the exotic to separate themselves from the common folk who unquestioningly follow the local customs and laws, and to express their sense of superiority. Otherwise, they would act with more dignity, showing respect for those who do not share their desires. Indeed, their need to show their differences so dramatically often makes them disliked by the people whose beliefs they challenge, indirectly and subtly perhaps, but offensively nonetheless. As Thucydides wrote of Pausanias, "By his contempt for laws and his imitation of foreign ways, he had made himself very widely suspected of being unwilling to abide by normal standards." Cultures have norms that reflect centuries of shared beliefs and ideals. Do not expect to scoff at such things with impunity. You will be punished somehow, even if just through isolation, a position of real powerlessness. Many of us, like Pausanias, feel the siren call of the exotic, the foreign. Measure and moderate this desire. Flaunting your pleasure in alien ways of thinking and acting will reveal a different motive, to demonstrate your superiority over your fellows. Observance of the law. During the late 16th century, a violent reaction against the Protestant Reformation erupted in Italy. The Counter-Reformation, as it was called, included its own version of the Inquisition, to root out all deviations from the Catholic Church. Among its victims was the scientist Galileo, but an important thinker who suffered even greater persecution was the Dominican monk and philosopher Tommaso Campanella. A follower of the materialist doctrine of the Roman philosopher Epicurus, Campanella did not believe in miracles or in heaven and hell. The church had promoted such superstitions, he wrote, to control the common folk by keeping them in fear. Such ideas verged on atheism, and Campanella expressed them incautiously. In 1593, the Inquisition threw him into prison for his heretical beliefs. 6 years later, as a form of partial release, he was confined to a monastery in Naples. Southern Italy was controlled by Spain at the time, and in Naples, Campanella became involved in a plot to fight and throw out these invaders. His hope was to establish an independent republic based on his own ideas of utopia. The leaders of the Italian Inquisition, working with their Spanish counterparts, had him imprisoned again. This time they also tortured him, to discover the true nature of his impious beliefs. He was subjected to the infamous La Veglia, a torture in which he was suspended by his arms in a squatting position a few inches above a seat studded with spikes. The posture was impossible to sustain, and in time the victim would end up sitting on the spikes, which would tear his flesh at the slightest contact. During these years, however, Campanella learned something about power. Facing the prospect of execution for heresy, he changed his strategy. He would not renounce his beliefs, yet he knew he had to disguise their outward appearance. To save his life, Campanella feigned madness. He let his inquisitors imagine that his beliefs stemmed from an incontrollable unsoundness of mind. For a while the tortures continued to see if his insanity was faked. But in 1603 his sentence was commuted to life in prison. The first 4 years of this he spent chained to a wall in an underground dungeon. Despite such conditions, he continued to write, although no longer would he be so foolish as to express his ideas directly. One book of Campanella's, The Hispanic Monarchy, promoted the idea that Spain had a divine mission to expand its powers around the world, and offered the Spanish king practical Machiavelli-type advice for achieving this. Despite his own interest in Machiavelli, the book in general presented ideas completely the opposite to his own. The Hispanic monarchy was, in fact, a ploy, an attempt to show his conversion to orthodoxy in the boldest manner possible. It worked. In 1626, 6 years after its publication, the Pope finally let Campanella out of prison. Shortly after gaining his freedom, Campanella wrote Atheism Conquered, a book attacking freethinkers, Machiavellians, Calvinists, and heretics of all stripes. The book is written in the form of debates in which heretics express their beliefs and are countered by arguments for the superiority of Catholicism. Campanella had obviously reformed. His book made that clear. Or did it? The arguments in the mouths of the heretics had never before been expressed with such verve and freshness. Pretending to present their side only to knock it down, Campanella actually summarized the case against Catholicism with striking passion. When he argued the other side, supposedly his side, on the other hand, he resorted to stale clichés and convoluted rationales. Brief and eloquent, the heretics' arguments seemed bold and sincere. The lengthy arguments for Catholicism seemed tiresome and unconvincing. Catholics who read the book found it disturbing and ambiguous, but they could not claim it was heretical, or that Campanella should be returned to prison. His defense of Catholicism, after all, used arguments they had used themselves. Yet in the years to come, Atheism Conquered became a Bible for atheists, Machiavellians, and libertines who used the arguments Campanella had put in their mouths to defend their dangerous ideas. Combining an outward display of conformity with an expression of his true beliefs in a way that his sympathizers would understand, Campanella showed that he had learned his lesson. Interpretation. In the face of awesome persecution, Campanella devised three strategic moves that saved his hide, freed him from prison, and allowed him to continue to express his beliefs. First, he feigned madness, the medieval equivalent of disavowing responsibility for one's actions, like blaming one's parents today. Next, he wrote a book that expressed the exact opposite of his own beliefs. Finally, and most brilliantly of all, he disguised his ideas while insinuating them at the same time. It is an old but powerful trick. You pretend to disagree with dangerous ideas, but in the course of your disagreement, you give those ideas expression and exposure. You seem to conform to the prevailing orthodoxy, but those who know will understand the irony involved. You are protected. It is inevitable in society that certain values and customs lose contact with their original motives and become oppressive. And there will always be those who rebel against such oppression, harboring ideas far ahead of their time. As Campanella was forced to realize, however, there is no point in making a display of your dangerous ideas if they only bring you suffering and persecution. Martyrdom serves no purpose. Better to live on in an oppressive world, even to thrive in it. Meanwhile, find a way to express your ideas subtly for those who understand you. Laying your pearls before swine will only bring you trouble. As Machiavelli said, For a long time I have not said what I believed, nor do I ever believe what I say. And if indeed sometimes I do happen to tell the truth, I hide it among so many lies that it is hard to find. Keys to Power. We all tell lies and hide our true feelings, for complete expression is a social impossibility. From an early age we learn to conceal our thoughts, telling the prickly and insecure what we know they want to hear, watching carefully lest we offend them. For most of us, this is natural. There are ideas and values that most people accept, and it is pointless to argue. We believe what we want to, then, but on the outside we wear a mask. There are people, however, who see such restraints as an intolerable infringement on their freedom, and who have a need to prove the superiority of their values and beliefs. In the end, though, their arguments convince only a few, and offend a great deal more. The reason arguments do not work is that most people hold their ideas and values without thinking about them. There is a strong emotional content in their beliefs. They really don't want to have to rework their habits of thinking. And when you challenge them, whether directly through your arguments or indirectly through your behavior, they are hostile. Wise and clever people learn early on that they can display conventional behavior and mouth conventional ideas without having to believe in them. The power these people gain from blending in is that of being left alone to have the thoughts they want to have, and to express them to the people they want to express them to, without suffering isolation or ostracism. Once they have established themselves in a position of power, they can try to convince a wider circle of the correctness of their ideas, perhaps working indirectly, using Campanella's strategies of irony and insinuation. In the late 14th century, the Spanish began a massive persecution of the Jews, murdering thousands and driving others out of the country. Those who remained in Spain were forced to convert. Yet over the next 300 years, the Spanish noticed a phenomenon that disturbed them. Many of the converts lived their outward lives as Catholics, yet somehow managed to retain their Jewish beliefs, practicing the religion in private. Many of these so-called Marranos, originally a derogatory term, being the Spanish for pig, attained high levels of government office, married into the nobility, and gave every appearance of Christian piety, only to be discovered late in life as practicing Jews. The Spanish Inquisition was specifically commissioned to ferret them out. Over the years, they mastered the art of dissimulation, displaying crucifixes liberally, giving generous gifts to churches, even occasionally making anti-Semitic remarks, and all the while maintaining their inner freedom and beliefs. In society, the Marranos knew, outward appearances are what matter. This remains true today. The strategy is simple. As Campanella did in writing Atheism Conquered, make a show of blending in, even going so far as to be the most zealous advocate of the prevailing orthodoxy. If you stick to conventional appearances in public, few will believe you think differently in private. Do not be so foolish as to imagine that in our own time the old orthodoxies are gone. Jonas Salk, for instance, thought science had gotten past politics and protocol. And so, in his search for a polio vaccine, he broke all the rules, going public with a discovery before showing it to the scientific community, taking credit for the vaccine without acknowledging the scientists who had paved the way, making himself a star. The public may have loved him, but scientists shunned him. His disrespect for his community's orthodoxies left him isolated, and he wasted years trying to heal the breach and struggling for funding and cooperation. Bertolt Brecht underwent a modern form of inquisition, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and approached it with considerable canniness. Having worked off and on in the American film industry during World War II, in 1947 Brecht was summoned to appear before the committee to answer questions on his suspected communist sympathies. Other writers called before the committee had made a point of attacking its members, and of acting as belligerently as possible in order to gain sympathy for themselves. Brecht, on the other hand, who had actually worked steadfastly for the communist cause, played the opposite game. He answered questions with ambiguous generalities that defied easy interpretation. Call it the Campanella strategy. Brecht even wore a suit, a rare event for him, and made a point of smoking a cigar during the proceedings, knowing that a key committee member had a passion for cigars. In the end, he charmed the committee members, who let him go scot-free. Brecht then moved to East Germany, where he encountered a different